Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
I've got something a bit different this week. Our covered bond editor, Bill Thornhill, is retiring after many years covering that market for us. So we thought it was the perfect opportunity, and frankly, our final opportunity, to get his thoughts on the covered bond market and where it's headed. So that's coming up later. Now, also, don't forget to ask GC. This is a new feature we're running, and we're here to answer any of your capital markets questions. Just send me a direct message on LinkedIn or email podcast@globalcapital.com. Now, I should say, we do have a question to answer, but we think it's going to take an entire episode to do so. So we're going to work on that and do a proper job of it. So bear with us for that. And we also have another event to talk about, and that's the second edition of GC Live, isn't it, John?
Yes. On the 27th of February in London, we're holding a GC Live event on the emerging asset class of SSA hybrids, supranational, sovereign and agency, well, not sovereigns, but development banks essentially issuing hybrid capital, which is a very exciting trend in the capital markets at the moment. Everyone in the market is waiting for the African Development Bank to issue its first hybrid capital deal, which it roadshowed back in September and, you know, believes there's support for, but has not brought to market because it's worried about the stability of the market, essentially, and it wants to get optimal pricing and choose the very best moment. We believe that deal is coming before long, but the issuer is still being very careful about when it brings it to market. But this is an extremely exciting asset class. There'll be other issuers apart from the African Development Bank. And so we're getting together a group of market participants in London to discuss in a sort of mini conference with three panel discussions early in the morning.
That's right. Now, two of those discussions will be completely off the record. So your only way to get to meet anyone there or to listen to what is said is to be at the event. And you can't buy a ticket either. It's only open to trialists of Global Capital. You can go and register for a trial for free on the website or subscribers. So even better, get your corporate card out and subscribe to the service and you'll be able to attend. Now, to this week's capital markets events. Now, most of the capital markets seem to be going great guns at the moment, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the sterling market in particular, where there have been a couple of very interesting developments that might have gotten missed among all the records being smashed elsewhere. And if it wasn't for Mike Turner, our corporate bond reporter, and Addison Gong and Georgie Lee, our SSA bond market reporting team, these may well have gone under the radar for many. I guess the first thing we should then talk about is corporate bonds, John. There have been some very interesting debut deals, haven't there, in the market this week?
Yes, the market's in great shape. And early in the year, to have two debut deals by big German companies, big bond issuers in the euro market, is exciting for the sterling market. We had Vonovia, which is a large housing company. They essentially grew by buying up what used to be public sector or industrial companies' housing portfolio. So they've got a large number of flats in Germany. And Traton, which is the truck subsidiary of Volkswagen. So they both came to the sterling market this week and got extremely strong receptions.
Vonovia is particularly interesting. Keen listeners to the podcast and readers of Global Capital will have followed Mike's coverage of real estate companies in general. And they've had a tough time coming to market, haven't they? So that's quite a notable deal.
Yes. I mean, Vonovia is probably one of the top two real estate companies in Europe, as the bond market regards them. The other being Unibail Rodamco Westfield, which is a shopping centres group. But Vonovia being housing, you know, it is a safe asset class. It's not completely without problems, but nevertheless, you know, we do know, even if we're worried about people still going shopping physically or still going into the office, we certainly know that they're still going to want housing. And that fundamental reason makes Vonovia a good credit that is trusted by the market.
Well, tell us about those two German deals then in a bit more detail. What were they and what was so spectacular about them?
Yeah, so it was really the size of demand that was most impressive. Vonovia's rated high triple B and A minus by Fitch, so it's a strong credit. It brought a 12-year bond to the sterling market and got enormous book of £3.45 billion, which came down slightly when at the final pricing, but basically stayed over 3 billion quid. And that was for a £400 million bond. And, you know, it was the biggest sterling order book for a senior bond in the corporate market since a deal in 2021. So 3 years ago, that was a Whitbread deal. What really excited the market about this, I think, is that it's a strong credit, but it was quite cheap. You know, because of the way real estate companies are trading, Vonovia offers probably a wider spread than is justified by its rating. And investors loved it. So it started at 190 basis points over gilts and got down to 157. Another reason why investors, of course, are loving bonds in sterling at the moment is just the basic yields. That bond is a 5.5% coupon. You know, investors in general in the capital markets at the moment are absolutely eager to buy bonds because they worry that the present high interest rates will not last long, you know, and they're desperately trying to lock in these high rates before they start to be cut.
And what was the other deal? That was from Traton,
wasn't it? Yeah, so Traton, you know, perhaps a bit more of a difficult credit. It's a cyclical industry, trucks. You know, it's obviously a strong company and part of Volkswagen, but nevertheless, you know, there have been times when issuers like that have had a tougher time in the market, but it also went very well. This was a 5-year bond, £450 million. It got a peak demand of 1.75 billion, and which came down to 1.2 billion. And, you know, so generally very successful deal.
And what is it about the sterling market that's allowing issuers to price bonds this successfully at the moment?
Sterling obviously is not a new thing, right? It's always been there. And, you know, sophisticated European issuers, particularly issuers like the car finance banks, like Volkswagen, Daimler and so on, they've tapped it from time to time, particularly at the short end, partly because they have loans in sterling, but also because often it offers arbitrage against euros. And this is essentially that sometimes when market conditions are right, it can price in sterling either not too much wider than or even flat to or even sometimes tighter than they could achieve in euros and swap the proceeds back to euros. Now, sterling is offering good funding costs at the moment. Vonovia, we think, came flat to what it could have priced at in euros. You know, that's why issuers are keen to look at it. And the underlying reason for that is just the strong demand in sterling. There were a lot of redemptions of sterling corporate bonds in December. And, you know, there hasn't been that much issuance. So there's basically investors have got cash. They like the bond market and they're putting it to work.
And of course, the Bank of England has stopped selling corporate bonds yeah, into the market too.
That's another thing that slightly took a bit of the shine off the market. The Bank of England had built up a corporate bond portfolio as part of quantitative easing, and it worked that off by selling into the market. But there was really remarkably little disruption from that.
This sounds like a market then that's ripe for other debut issuers to approach. What sort of issuers will it attract?
Yes, I think it's going to be, the sterling investors are pretty sophisticated. You know, they will look at credit of all kinds and they like yield, you know, so issuers that offer that, they will look at. They're not sort of conservative and narrow-minded investors at all. However, the ones that are most likely to try this are going to be the big issuers, which have larger funding programs. They're the ones that value diversifying their investor bases. You know, if you are issuing several bonds a year and you're based in the euro market, sterling, it will be something to look at for them. So it'll be the big blue chips. And Ralph, there's also been interesting activity in the public sector part of the sterling bond market too this week, hasn't there? Which our SSA editor, Addison Gong, wrote a very interesting story about.
That's right. She and Georgie Lee, the SSA reporter, have been on the case with this one for a couple of weeks. And it is exciting for the SSA market. But of course, what's exciting for the SSA market often seems very subtle to others. And basically, the big change is how issuers are marketing their bonds when they bring them. And what they're doing is, instead of marketing them at spread over gilts, three quarters of this year's deals have been marketed at spread over swaps instead. That might not sound like much, but that is a big change. Not just because it changes the market convention, but it's a change for a group of issuers that, you know, have always traditionally prized themselves on their predictability and a very sort of conservative approach to issuance.
But of course, we should say that the context for this is also roaringly strong market for sterling SSA bonds, isn't it? And sterling is a market that the global SSA community sometimes bother with, you know, when it's attractive, but they certainly can leave it alone for months at a time. And but it's been going great guns, hasn't it, this year?
Yeah, that's right. First five trading days of the year, there were £6.5 billion worth of new SSA bonds in the currency. That's already more than the entirety of January last year. So the average deal size is up by more than £300 million compared to a year ago. Now, bear in mind that a benchmark issuance in sterling is deemed to be £250 million or bigger. And that really does show you quite how on fire this market is at the moment.
So what are some of the issues that have come to sterling?
Well, I think probably the first deal we should talk about was one that was actually done last week by the European Investment Bank. That was the first deal out this year that was priced over swaps. They did £1 billion of bonds due January 2032. They brought that at 40 basis points over swaps, which is equivalent to about 15 and a bit basis points over gilts. It's often the case that an issuer like the EIB will be the sort of one of the leaders for a sort of change in tactics or a way to market deals, and so it proved. And then that's continued this week, really. The Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank sold £500 million of 4% July 2027s last week too, and then OKB, the Austrian issuer, managed to get its largest benchmark in the currency and its largest ever book in the currency. It did a £500 million July 2027 bond, and that attracted £840 million of orders.
We should introduce at this point Sonia, shouldn't we?
Yes, we should.
The sterling overnight index average, which is the new interest rate benchmark for swaps in sterling, isn't it? After the disappearance of LIBOR.
Yeah,
this new style of pricing is actually over Sonia, isn't it? Tell us a bit about, Ralph, what are the sort of pros and cons? Obviously, Sonia and swaps in general have existed for a long time. It's not that they're new. So why are people sort of thinking that it's now a good idea to price bonds over them?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the core markets for SSA funding, euros and dollars, deals are very often marketed against swaps and have been for decades. So it's kind of strange that in some ways that the sterling market was still so heavily skewed towards pricing over gilts only and not swaps. So this is a sort of piece of modernization, really. You might call it that. Now, it has a number of advantages. The first one is that when you price a bond over another bond, you might not have the same maturity date and you will probably have different coupons. And that leads to what's called a duration mismatch. That is to say, when the underlying market moves, the price of those two assets, the government bond, the reference bond, and your bond, the prices will change by different amounts, which makes for it very hard to sort of calculate the sort of relative value, and it makes it kind of awkward to see what you're getting when you price.
And we should say, Ralph, that it's sort of conventional in the sterling market, isn't it? Although the banks bringing a deal to market will look at the interpolated gilt curve between the various actual gilts that exist in the market, And this is particularly the case at the longer end, where the bond maturities are spaced out more, isn't it? But they will also eventually price the bond over a specific gilt, and it's sort of conventional in the market as to which one is used, isn't it, for each maturity?
Yeah, that's right. You pick the on the run is called bond at the closest maturity, generally speaking. And of course, you know, you have to do that because you have to price you have to pick a reference price in the market at the time you price your bond. And you can only do that for an actual bond. You can't really pick a price for an interpolated point on a curve. Now, that interpolation is interesting because, of course, that solves your problem of mismatched maturities, so that you can see where the relative value of your bond is versus the underlying curve. The swaps get around that because, of course, you know, you can structure an interest rate swap to the exact term you want, the exact maturity date you want. So you always know that when you're marketing a deal versus swaps, you're looking at something, you're looking at a reference point that's got the exact same dates. It's a perfect sort of opportunity cost, as it were. As a sort of an alternative.
Now, the sterling market obviously has its conventions. One of them is pricing over gilts. It's very well established. And I think the reason why this hasn't happened before in sterling is that it was just seen as a sort of conventional thing that you didn't want to change. In fact, the head of funding at the World Bank, Andrea Dore, told our SSA team last week that the World Bank was sort of cautious about making this change for that very reason. But so people have started to change this tradition, particularly this week, but also last week. And what's been the reaction then from this sort of supposedly quite traditional market?
Yeah, it's been fine. No one's batted an eyelid. It's interesting. KfW was another issuer that chose to stick with pricing over gilts last week, along with the World Bank. And they're showing that classic sort of SSA issuer caution for doing anything differently. But the issuers that did price bonds versus swaps have experienced no problem with it at all. Indeed, Monica Seitelberger, who is the Director of Treasury at the OKB, said that many banks say this should have happened a long time ago. It seems that investors have been comfortable with this change and often do not require a spread versus gilts. So it's pretty clear that it's kind of worked, and everyone's kind of wondering why we didn't do this earlier. I think what's notable about it is it tells you something about the changing investor base in the sterling bond market. If you were selling to the traditional crowd of UK-based investors that look at everything versus the gilt market, then that's why these bonds have always been priced versus gilts. What we're seeing now, though, is many more bank treasuries buying bonds in the sterling market. And they, for reasons of their business, look at everything on a floating rate basis. So the swap market is much more relevant to them. Obviously, swap rates go up and down like any other sort of floating interest rate. And so really, it's about targeting those buyers and showing them the value of the bonds against how they want to buy it.
Yeah, and up to 60%, I think, of some of the deals this week have gone to bank treasuries, haven't they?
That's right.
Now, obviously, that is because these are SSA bonds, which are, you know, banks want to buy those because they're regarded as high quality liquid assets. You know, they tick a regulatory box, and they don't have much yield. The banks aren't buying them for yield fundamentally. They just need these assets and to have a decent spread. They're obviously thinking of it already as versus swaps, aren't they? Mm. And making that the sort of explicit target in pricing makes sense for the issuers too. That's the case, isn't it, Ralph?
It's very handy. It's a very handy match off, as you said, John. Yeah, something like up to 60% of these order books, the investors are buying them asset swapped. So to explain what that means, they will buy the bonds, but they will also enter into an asset swap with another party, usually one of the lead managers in this case, just because of how it works. And they will effectively, in this swap, pay the coupons that they receive on the bond and then receive back a floating rate of interest. Now, on the other side of that operation, the issuer is also entering into a sort of hedging interest rate swap at the time the bond is priced, but the opposite way round. The issuer has a liability on its bond coupons, which is it has to find a fixed rate payment every so often. But a lot of SSA issuers want to hedge their interest rate risk of, you know, they don't want to find in 2 years' time that they're now paying massively over the odds for a bond coupon. So what they do is they enter this sort of new issue swap at the time where they receive those fixed rate payments from the bank in the swap, but they pay a floating rate of interest in return. Now, if you think about those two situations, you now have a position where the bank that sits in the middle that has to take on the risk of providing those hedges now has a perfectly offset risk, and a perfectly offset risk in terms of, you know, anyone who looks at in terms of gilt spread too, for those two sides. So it can minimize the amount it charges either side in that trade for its own risk. And that makes the whole business a lot more efficient.
Yeah. So just to be clear, that swapping process was going on anyway, and yes, it hasn't changed. But pricing the bond over asset swaps makes it slightly more efficient to do those swaps and just removes one element of short-term volatility and therefore a bit of cost.
Yeah, that's right. Because now many fewer people are worried about the spread to gilts. And so no one has to worry about swap spreads moving around in sterling.
There is a fly in the ointment, of course, which is that if you are an investor, say a big institutional house, a pension fund or so on, that does benchmark your returns against gilts, you know, pricing it over swaps means you have to then do the conversion and sort of work out whether you're getting the right relative value. And I wonder whether, I mean, certainly the it didn't seem to have taken off in the corporate bond market yet, where probably more of the investors are of that type rather than bank treasuries. So we'll see how it evolves. But of course, in the euro market, you know, which is huge, bonds are priced over swaps. So investors are used to it.
Well, this is it. I mean, I think, you know, so it's not a particular mystery how to work from a swap spread back into a spread over an underlying gilt or any other reference point for that matter. Indeed, in euros and dollars, the lead managers of a bond will market the bond at both spreads. It just happens to be that the primary one will be the swap spread, and the spread to the government bond will just move in accordance with how the swap market behaves. So in the sterling market, issuers were still mindful before of the swap spread. They were still, although the deal was being marketed against gilts, they were still mindful of what the level was against swaps in the first place, so they could bring the bond at an attractive level for those buyers. I guess it just sort of suggests that there's been a sort of shift in the balance of power, or the balance of orders, perhaps, as to what type of investors are now driving the market.
Yeah, so there's bound to be lots more interesting things to discover in the sterling market this year. Staying in the UK, in fact, one little nugget I think that is worth highlighting today, and this is something that's just come out this morning, is an equity deal on the London Stock Exchange, a company called the London Tunnels PLC. And they've already raised £10 million from investors, and they're going to be raising another £30 million once they get on the exchange. But the curious thing about this company is that they're planning to revive something called the Kingsway Exchange Tunnels, which is a set of tunnels right in the heart of London. If you're a Londoner, or you've been here, you'll know where Kingsway is, near the Strand. And there's a sort of intriguing tunnel entrance there that isn't used anymore. But it turns out there's a sort of a curious network of tunnels under the city, which have been used in the past for all kinds of sort of strange and historic things.
That's fascinating. That was something that used to baffle us, me and my friends, when we were students, when we were walking from our halls down to university, and we would walk right past that entrance.
Yeah.
I remember having many conversations with my dad about it when he worked in a building right opposite, and we did all sorts of research and looked into the tunnels and what was down there. So the chance to go down there legally will be absolutely fantastic.
That's right. And it turns out that they apparently inspired James Bond's Q branch, because the special operations executive during the war was based there for a time. They were used to protect Londoners from the Blitz, and there was also the hotline between the White House and the Kremlin during the Cuban Missile Crisis somehow ran through these tunnels. Anyway, the company behind this have got a project to turn it into some kind of you know, venue to attract
luxury flats and a few branches of Brett.
Probably not flats, but yeah, I'm sure Brett and Monge will probably come into it. But there'll be some sort of tourist attraction anyway.
Oh, well, that's great. All right. Well, we're very much looking forward to that. In the meantime, we spoke to Bill Thornhill about the covered bond market. Hello, Bill, and welcome for what is rather sadly the final time to the Global Capital Podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm off to sunnier climes.
Yes, you are.
In
yes,
a few weeks.
Are. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, obviously, pretty much every week we have journalists on the podcast or interviewing them, but they're not usually the subject of the show. But I think, you know, in this case, it's rare we have any journalists that reach retirement age at Global Capital, which is not to say that we work people that hard. But I thought perhaps, you know, you have a very interesting beginning to your career as far as trading is concerned. Let's start there before we get on to what you've been doing lately in the covered bond market with which you're so closely associated. Tell us how it all started out.
Well, it started out about 40 years ago. So in the mid 80s, I was working for a subsidiary of Cargill up in Liverpool, trading cotton, believe it or not. I was originating cotton from French West Africa and selling it to mills in Taiwan and other places in the Far East. And it was an opening into the whole idea of trading, because we used to hedge stuff on the New York Futures Exchange. And that kind of got me interested a bit in financial markets. It was a fantastic job. I really loved it. The people were great. And it was a bit like wine tasting, in a sense, that you had all these different grades of cotton, and there was a real kind of expertise to understanding, you know, the trade. And people would tell me at the time, once you're a cotton merchant, you're always a cotton merchant. And I thought that was a bit of a death sentence. So I left after about, three or four years.
And so, I mean, Liverpool's obviously pretty handily located if you're dealing with the US, Taiwan and Africa. I mean, presumably you weren't in contact with the physical cotton or anything like that.
No, I mean, it's there for historical reasons. Mm. It was, you know, cotton and wool was imported in, you know, during the Industrial Revolution into this country via Liverpool. And, you know, just for historic reasons, the head office of this company, which was called Raleigh Brothers and Coney, were based up there in Liverpool. But they were subsequently bought up by Cargill, who everybody knows.
Okay, so you were presumably there with one phone permanently open to New York, one phone permanently open to Asia, and then another phone balanced on your shoulder talking directly.
It wasn't like that at all. No, it wasn't. It was a gentleman's club. It was, you know, we sat around this huge room, and the boss would come in smoking a cigar, and he was a real old school boy. And in fact, it was actually a proper gentleman's club. And we sat around on these massive desks. And it was, the culture of it was very genteel.
All right. So after that point, you were banging to markets and, you came down to the big smoke to seek your fortune. Tell us what you did next, then how you ended up writing about covered bonds.
Oh, it's a bit of a long story, but, you know, Big Bang was going on. My better half at that time, who I later got married to, joined up with First Interstate Bank of California. And I was thinking, gosh, she's going to make loads of money and do much better than me. I need to be down in London. So I followed her down in London and went through a series of jobs fairly quickly in spot foreign exchange. Which really was the complete opposite end of the spectrum in terms of culture compared to cotton trading. But it gave me a very good feel, you know, of the dealing and trading market. And after doing that for about 2 years, 2.5 years, I ended up getting a position with Informa Global Markets, where I started off as a technical analyst. And I did that for a few years, working on their Yield Watch service, which I'm not sure if that still exists, but it may do. And then I graduated to what was then Thomson Reuters, working on money markets, again as a technical analyst, but more and more writing about bond markets. And then after about 2 or 3 years, I moved over to join as the number two economist as we were heading into monetary union, the single currency. And I was writing then about Italy and Spain, Portugal and Greece, and all the fiscal chicanery that they were getting up to get their books in order to show that they could get a 3% deficit GDP ratio and various other sort of methods to take things off the book. I think Goldman Sachs would have a thing to say about that, because I believe they did some off-balance sheet trades, which were quite interesting at the time. Anyway, Greece got in the last moment, and monetary union went ahead, and I went away sort of late 99, early 2000. I'd had a house being built in India up in the Himalayas. I went to go and live up there for a year, but it was going to be a very romantic idea, but it turned out to be quite dull in the end. And I decided to come back to the UK, and I reapplied to Thomson Financial, and they said, we can take you on at IFR on the cover bond side, but you're not allowed to write about primary markets. So at that time, they had somebody called Christoph and Monica Vetter, and they were all writing about SSAs and cover bonds. But I was only allowed to write secondary markets. But at that time, secondary markets were, there was a market maker agreement. It was extremely liquid. And I was getting quite scoopy stuff from these traders. And that's kind of where I made my name, basically, just passing on info between these traders and getting a story which was so completely different from what the syndicate was telling. People sort of sat up and noticed. And I did that for a few years. I then went off and wrote about structured finance through the global financial crisis, which was interesting.
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, Bill, I'm surprised that you know, people typically go off to India to find themselves, and I've known you now for a number of years, and I'm very surprised to discover that you found yourself and got bored. this would not be my anticipated outcome. But John, you wanted to ask something.
Well, Bill, I'm also curious. I mean, you changed direction quite sharply from being a natural trader, you know, in the FX market, to then becoming a writer, and you know, was that difficult, or did you ever regret it?
I didn't regret it at all. And you say natural trader, but actually I wasn't a natural trader. I thought too much. And that was in those days, I think thinking in the spot FX market was frowned upon. You had to act and trade on moves. And I suppose it was a bit of a culture shock for me going into FX from the cotton business, and I was never really at home trading FX at all. But when I started to go onto the other side, that actually felt a much better fit for me. I was much happier there, less stressful, and really felt that I was doing a good job. So no, it was absolutely the right thing to do at the time.
I mean, I think that's really informed your coverage of how you cover bond markets and how you are in the newsroom. You have a very natural, what feels like a very natural approach to the numbers behind the markets, especially compared to some of the other journalists, I think in a more story-led way, if I can put it like that. Whereas you have a greater affinity with how markets are moving, I think, sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, having sort of worked on a trading floor and understand the mentality of these people, it really does give you an idea into what they're looking for, you know, which is quite often, actually. I mean, it's very nice to write long, eloquent, well-argued pieces, but it's also really good to get stuff which is out there providing news before anyone else, which is very hard hitting and moves markets. I mean, there's a tremendous sense of positive feedback when you do that.
Yeah.
And it can only be a 300 word story or even three or four lines. It's just you got there first, you beat everyone else, the market's moved, and people are saying, why didn't we get that new service? We need that new service.
Absolutely.
So then the financial crisis came, Bill. How did that affect you?
It was really interesting times. By that stage, I was working at IFR on structured finance, and I remember going to a conference where people were saying, we don't see how the subprime crisis can affect Europe, and we don't see the transmission mechanism of how that can happen. And then that was in spring. And then I think it was in September, Northern Rock usually did their program, Granite. They used to always do a deal in September. And we basically said, if they don't do this deal in September, they're screwed. And guess what? They didn't do the deal in September. We saw all the queues around Northern Rock. And that was kind of the beginning of the transmission mechanism between the US subprime crisis and Europe. That's kind of how it started for me. But there were all sorts of other things going on in the background, which were sort of quite interesting as well. I mean, we had all the what they were called structured investment vehicles, which were the shadow banking things. And though they had a very small exposure to subprime, but that was enough to prevent them from getting borrowing money on their money market funds. They had to sell out all their assets, which included European ABS, which actually performed really well. But because there were no buyers, it just went at distressed levels, and anyone who was lucky enough to pick it up retired on it effectively. And there were many people in the business who did that.
So Bill, you joined Global Capital, well, it was called Euroweek back then, not long after me. You joined in 2011, and you've been writing about covered bonds ever since. From that point up until now, I mean, well, what was the covered bond market like back then compared to now?
Okay, so back in 2011, you know, we were just in the period leading up to the sort of sovereign bond crisis. I think that was the following year. People were unable to access senior unsecured, and spreads in covered bonds were extremely wide, but, you know, people could access the market. I seem to remember second tier Spanish names were offering something like 300 basis points over mid swaps for a 3-year cedulas, which is just incredible when you think about it. And then we saw the first covered bond purchase program. In the run up to 2012, we saw the European Central Bank start the first purchase program for covered bonds, the covered bond purchase program, CBPP1. The European Central Bank used that as it wasn't at that time used actually for quantitative easing. It was only by the third program that was quantitative easing. The first program was really designed to help contain spreads, which were extremely wide. But it did set in train, you know, once they'd gone down that route, as we know from history, they followed with subsequent purchase programs, and they widened it out to, you know, the sovereign market and supranationals and so forth. So that's kind of where it started, the first covered bond purchase program.
Yeah, I know that's just receding. So really, your entire time with us has been sort of, your market's completely defined by what's been going on at the ECB.
Absolutely. So they weren't there when I joined in December 2011, and they're not there now. So, but basically, you know, we've had a few months of them not being there at the tail end of my career with Euroweek. But the rest of the time, they've been there on and off pretty much for the last decade. Yeah, absolute distortion.
So, Bill, the ECB has finally left the covered bond market in the primary market. And so what are the market obsessing about now?
I guess it's good news. They've left the market. Spreads have widened quite a lot. And I suppose actually everything is looking pretty good at this point in time. Cover bonds offer a nice spread against the SSA product, and they also offer a good spread against senior unsecured. I was just checking up on the market iTraxx financials senior financials index today, and that was trading at 68, and we've had something like 10 covered bonds that have priced in the last 2 weeks, which are all AAA rated, at a spread of 50 basis points or over. It just doesn't make sense. So people are, you know, people are twigging onto that. You know, we've gotten these UK hedge funds and specialist buyers coming back into the market. The last time we saw these guys was just after the global financial crisis. So they're rare players, but they're obviously seeing value in the market. They bought heavily into this Crédit Agricole deal that was issued this week. I mean, the long and short of it is that cover bonds are in a pretty good place. People say, yes, the spreads may widen a bit from here, but most of that widening is done. And the more likely place for that widening is going to come in the senior unsecured sector. You've got all this structural demand because of their, you know, LCR inclusion, so bank demand there, which SSAs also benefit from.
This is banks that have to buy a covered bonds for their liquidity coverage ratio, isn't it?
And exactly, yeah. So structural demand, it's there, it's not there in senior, is there in covered. And yet senior is at its tights and covered's pretty much at the widest levels it's been for 10 years. What's not to like, you know? Just jump in there, it's in a pretty good state. I think just step one step back away from the covered bond market a little bit. I think the bigger concern is that we see, as we know, you know, there are multiple wars going on, there's a blockade in the Red Sea, container shipping prices are going up, against wages are sticky. Who knows what's going to happen to inflation? There are people are talking about a second wave of inflation. If that comes about, then, well, I think we have seen the peak in rates, but the short end probably stays anchored down, but the long end is going to have to reprice. And that spells trouble for a lot of the sovereign debt markets, because their servicing costs are, debt servicing costs are, you know, they're monstrous. They're going to go high. And that could in turn lead to a deeper than expected. Everybody's expecting a mild recession at worst. The risk is that it's longer and more drawn out than people are expecting. And one has to think that equities are not the place to be at the moment. They've hardly corrected at all. They're basically sort of being, you know, it's the great sort of tech boom at the moment on the equities, with AI meaning sort of driving everything. But I'd rather, you know, think covered bonds are well placed, actually. They are always and typically have always been considered, you know, the go-to product, rainy day product, as it were. And if you're expecting volatility, they're, you know, partly due to their illiquidity, they're not volatile. So it's a good place to have, you know, part of your portfolio in covered bonds. They offer a good pickup versus SSAs, and they're going to be a lot more stable than senior, which is trading at its tights. I mean, where's the upside in senior? There isn't any. Where's the upside in cover bonds? Even if, you know, markets stay where they are, the upside is that they're not volatile. So I actually, you know, I'm finishing my career, I think cover bonds are ending on a strong footing. You know, they've repriced largely. And, you know, these sort of French, Canadian, Nordic deals, which UK transactions, which offer good liquidity, and, you know, from large universal banks, which are well rated, you know, in the 5-year area, I think you'd be safe in something like that. That's basically what the covered bond market's all about.
I mean, covered bonds, speaking of higher rates, I mean, covered bonds are ultimately, you know, they're secured on mortgages, on commercial and residential properties mostly. Is there any fear to be had about, in particular, commercial real estate and where those loans sit in the pools underlying cover bonds?
Yes, there is. There's no doubt that, you know, the majority of the commercial real estate loans are being held in German and Austrian deals, and to some extent that has sort of eroded the sort of gold label status of the Pfandbrief market. And you've seen a tightening in the spread between Fanbrief and French cover bonds, which are largely issued by large universal banks and secured on, you know, highly granular residential mortgages. So I think the the German market is in the process of repricing, and it's probably fine. There are a couple of banks out there, and one in particular that may have trouble with some of their US CRE exposures, but the rest of them are absolutely fine, and they're a good rates product. But issuers in that region are tending to be a little bit greedy, and starting their pricing at too tight levels when they should be sort of starting wide, getting good book momentum, and then driving the spread in. And that's just, you know, we are seeing that with some deals, but especially that's the case with the second tier names. That, you know, the strong names in Germany won't have a problem, but the second tier German names and the Austrians need to be careful.
One other thing, Bill, covered bonds are very central, of course, to the whole prospects of greening the property sector in Europe, aren't they? Which, of course, property is one of the hugest suppliers of greenhouse gas emissions through heating homes and the energy we use in them. And, you know, there's been a lot of effort to use cover bonds to sort of finance the greening of that. What's the state of play on that?
So, I mean, essentially, the green market is doing well in cover bonds. And I would say that it's basically the top 15% in any country of energy efficient mortgages are the ones that become eligible for the cover pool. And by and large, most issuers are able to find the top 15%. The problem that there is further down the line is that we have these energy performance certificates, which are, you know, labels A down to H, I believe, and they all mean different things in different countries. So trying to homogenize those across Europe and the UK is a pointless exercise. I think, well, at the moment, it would be a good exercise to do, but at the moment you can't compare an A-class property in, for example, in the Netherlands with an A-class EPC property, for example, in France. They mean totally different things. And I think there has been some confusion amongst investors about, you know, really what emissions they're saving, what energy they're using, because the top, you know, A means different things in different countries, and that's work that needs to be done.
But doesn't the 15% standard, isn't that a way to get around that problem?
It has got around that problem, but as far as I'm aware, the European Commission seems to be very keen on driving up the standards of properties, and the vast majority of properties are, you know, historical older ones which need refurbishing. So it's all very well, you know, raising building standards for new properties, but that's only represents a small minority of the housing stock. What really needs to happen is, you know, there needs to be a wholesale rethink about how governments are going to go about incentivizing landlords and residents, owners of their properties, to refinance. And one way that could be done is by offering cheap loans to them, or just simply subsidizing them in some way. But people aren't necessarily going to make those. I mean, they're vast expenses, and they're not all, the upside is not always guaranteed. For example, putting an air source heat pump in your home and running it off solar panels during the winter, well, you know, that's problematic. More people die of cold than they do of heat. So serious thinking has got to be done, which is practical, about how, you know, refurbing homes, especially in Northern Europe, is actually going to work.
So, Bill, not that, you know, I'm fishing for editorial ideas here, but, you know, well, obviously, you know, there will be a new covered bond editor at Global Capital in due course. What would be the, you know, if you were to leave a note for them in the way that the UK Treasury Minister famously left a note for his successor in after the 2010 election in his desk saying there's no money left. I guess you wouldn't say anything quite so bleak, but what note would you leave for your successor? What three things should they care about the most when coming to cover the covered bond market?
Well, there is a big sense of community in the covered bond market, which drew me to it in the first place. And, all doors are open. People are there ready to talk. And I think if you've got a problem or an issue, then there's always someone in the covered bond community who's willing and able to talk and give you expert opinion. I would say it's a very open market. And it's on a very strong, as I've already explained, I think it's on a strong footing. And my advice would be to keep as close to your contacts as possible and become part of the market, the voice for the market, if you like, own it.
Sound advice for any global capital journalist, I would suggest. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's been evident in your coverage, Bill, that how close you are to your market without being captured by it. I would say you've never pulled your punches when required.
I have felt at times that you do get that sense sometimes that you're being captured, and then you do you do have to step away a little bit.
Yeah.
It does go on. Yeah, yeah. It's, I think that, you know, the cozy relationship you have to step back from sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I hope your successor, whoever they may turn out to be, is listening to this, because that sounds like the best prep they can possibly get. In the meantime, Bill, all the very best to your retirement, and thank you. And I'm going to speak on behalf of the covered bond market, even though I have no place to do so. But I'm sure they would thank you for the years of detailed coverage and shedding light on what it is they do all day as well. So thank you very much and all the best.
Yep, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Bye.